A reward will be given for information leading to the discovery of such persons. The officers in charge appeal to all lodgers to assist them in keeping this hostel free from the detestable evil of gambling. Gambling or playing cards is a delightful phrase. To my eye, these Salvation Army shelters, though clean, are far drearier than the worst of the common lodging houses. There is such a hopelessness about some of the people there. Decent, broken-down types, who have pawned their collars but are still trying for office jobs. Coming to a Salvation Army shelter, where it is at least clean, is their last clutch at respectability. At the next table to me were two foreigners, dressed in rags but manifestly gentlemen. They were playing chess verbally, not even writing down the moves. One of them was blind, and I heard them say that they had been saving up for a long time to buy a board, price half a crown, but could never manage it. Here and there were clerks out of work, pallid and moody. Among a group of them, a tall, thin, deadly pale young man was talking excitedly. He thumped his fist on the table and boasted in a strange, feverish style. When the officers were out of hearing, he broke out into startling blasphemies. "I tell you what, boys, I'm going to get that job tomorrow. I'm not one of your bloody down-on-the-knee brigade. I can look after myself. Look at that fucking notice there. The Lord will provide. Ah, bloody lot he's ever provided me with. You don't catch me trusting at the fucking Lord. You leave it to me, boys. I'm going to get that job," etc., etc. I watched him, struck by the wild, agitated way in which he talked. He seemed hysterical, or perhaps a little drunk. An hour later, I went into a small room, apart from the main hall, which was intended for reading. It had no books or papers in it, so few of the lodgers went there. As I opened the door, I saw the young clerk in there all alone. He was on his knees, praying. Before I shut the door again, I had time to see his face, and it looked agonized. Quite suddenly, I realized, from the expression of his face, that he was starving. The charge for beds was eightpence. Paddy and I had fivepence left, and we spent it at the bar, where food was cheap, though not so cheap as in some common lodging houses. The tea appeared to be made with tea dust, which I fancy had been given to the Salvation Army in charity, though they sold it at threepence a cup. It was foul stuff. At 10 o'clock, an officer marched round the hall, blowing a whistle. Immediately, everyone stood up. "What's this for?" I said to Paddy, astonished. "That means you has to go off to bed, and you has to look sharp about it, too." Obediently as sheep, the whole 200 men trooped off to bed, under the command of the officers. The dormitory was a great attic, like a barrack room, with 60 or 70 beds in it. They were clean and tolerably comfortable, but very narrow and very close together, so that one breathed straight into one's neighbour's face. Two officers slept in the room, to see that there was no smoking and no talking after lights out. Paddy and I had scarcely a wink of sleep, for there was a man near to us who had some nervous trouble, shell shock, perhaps, which made him cry out, "Pip!" at irregular intervals. It was a loud, startling noise, something like the toot of a small motor horn. You never knew when it was coming, and it was a sure preventer of sleep. It appeared that Pip, as the others called him, slept regularly in the shelter, and he must have kept 10 or 20 people awake every night. He was an example of the kind of thing that prevents one from ever getting enough sleep when men are herded as they are in these lodging houses. At 7, another whistle blew, and the officers went round shaking those who did not get up at once. Since then I have slept in a number of Salvation Army shelters, and found that, though the different houses vary a little, this semi-military discipline is the same in all of them. They're certainly cheap, but they're too like workhouses for my taste. In some of them, there is even a compulsory religious service once or twice a week, which the lodgers must attend or leave the house. The fact is that the Salvation Army are so in the habit of thinking themselves a charitable body that they cannot even run a lodging house without making it stink of charity. At 10, I went to B's office and asked him to lend me £1. He gave me £2, and told me to come again when necessary, so that Paddy and I were free of money troubles for a week at least. We loitered the day in Trafalgar Square, looking for a friend of Paddy's who never turned up, and at night went to a lodging house in a back alley near the Strand. The charge was 11p, but it was a dark, evil-smelling place, and a notorious haunt of the Nancy boys. Downstairs in the murky kitchen, three ambiguous-looking youths in smartish blue suits were sitting on a bench apart, ignored by the other lodgers. I suppose they were Nancy boys. They looked the same type as the Apache boys one sees in Paris, except that they wore no side whiskers. In front of the fire, a fully dressed man and a stark naked man were bargaining. They were newspaper sellers. The dressed man was selling his clothes to the naked man. He said, "Here you are, the best rig out you ever had. A tosheroon, half a crown, for the coat, 2 hogs for the trousers, 1 and a tanner for the boots, 1 hog for the cap and scarf, that's 7 bob. You got hope. I'll give you 1 and a tanner for the coat, 1 hog for the trousers and 2 hogs for the rest, that's 4 and a tanner. Take the whole lot for 5 and a tanner, chum. Right you are, off with them. I've got to get out to sell my late edition." The clothed man stripped, and in 3 minutes their positions were reversed, the naked man dressed, and the other kilted with a sheet of the Daily Mail. The dormitory was dark and close, with 15 beds in it. There was a horrible hot reek of urine, so beastly that at first one tried to breathe in small, shallow puffs, not filling one's lungs to the bottom. As I lay down in bed, a man loomed out of the darkness, leant over me, and began babbling in an educated, half-drunken voice. "An old public schoolboy, he'd heard me say something to Paddy. "Don't meet many of the old school here. I'm an old Etonian, you know. 20 years hence, this weather and all that." He began to quaver out the Eton boating song, not untunefully. "Jolly boating weather, and a hey-ho." "Stop that fucking noise," shouted several lodgers. "Low types," said the old Etonian, "very low types. Funny sort of place for you and me, eh? Do you know what my friends say to me? They say, M, you are past redemption. Quite true. I am past redemption. I've come down in the world. Not like these shits here who couldn't come down if they tried. We chaps who have come down ought to hang together a bit. Youth will still be in our faces, you know. May I offer you a drink?" He produced a bottle of cherry brandy, and at the same moment lost his balance and fell heavily across my legs. Paddy, who was undressing, pulled him upright. "Get back to your bed, you silly old fucker." The old Etonian walked unsteadily to his bed and crawled under the sheets with all his clothes on, even his boots. Several times in the night I heard him murmuring, "M, you are past redemption," as though the phrase appealed to him. In the morning he was lying asleep, fully dressed, with the bottle clasped in his arms. He was a man of about 50, with a refined, worn face, and, curiously enough, quite fashionably dressed. It was queer to see his good patent leather shoes sticking out of that filthy bed. It occurred to me, too, that the cherry brandy must have cost the equivalent of a fortnight's lodging, so he couldn't have been seriously hard up. Perhaps he frequented common lodging houses in search of the Nancy boys. The beds were not more than 2 feet apart. About midnight, I woke up to find that the man next to me was trying to steal the money from beneath my pillow. He was pretending to be asleep while he did it, sliding his hand under the pillow as gently as a rat. In the morning I saw that he was a hunchback, with long, ape-like arms. I told Paddy about the attempted theft. He laughed and said, "Christ, you got to get used to that. These lodging houses is full of thieves. In some houses there's nothing safe but to sleep with all your clothes on. I seen him steal a wooden leg off a cripple before now. Once I see a man, 14 stone man he was, come into a lodging house with £4.10. He puts it under his mattress. 'Now,' he says, 'any fucker that touches that money does it over me body,' he says. But they done him all the same. In the morning he woke up on the floor. 4 fellas had took his mattress by the corners and lifted him off as light as a feather. He never saw his £4.10 again." Chapter 30. The next morning we began looking once more for Paddy's friend, who was called Bozo, and was a screever, that is, a pavement artist. Addresses did not exist in Paddy's world, but he had a vague idea that Bozo might be found in Lambeth, and in the end we ran across him on the embankment, where he had established himself not far from Waterloo Bridge. He was kneeling on the pavement with a box of chalks, copying a sketch of Winston Churchill from a penny notebook. The likeness was not at all bad. Bozo was a small, dark, hooked-nosed man, with curly hair growing low on his head. His right leg was dreadfully deformed, the foot being twisted heel forward in a way horrible to see. From his appearance, one could have taken him for a Jew, but he used to deny this vigorously. He spoke of his hooked nose as Roman, and was proud of his resemblance to some Roman emperor. It was Vespasian, I think. Bozo had a strange way of talking, cockneyfied, and yet very lucid and expressive. It was as though he had read good books, but had never troubled to correct his grammar. For a while, Paddy and I stayed on the embankment, talking, and Bozo gave us an account of the screeving trade. I repeat what he said more or less in his own words. "I'm what they call a serious screever. I don't draw in blackboard chalks like these others. I use proper colours, the same as what painters use. Bloody expensive they are, especially the reds. I use 5 bobs worth of colours in a long day, and never less than 2 bobs worth. Pavement artists buy their colours in the form of powder and work them into cakes with condensed milk. Cartoons is my line. You know, politics and cricket and that. Look here." He showed me his notebook. "Here's likenesses of all the political blokes, what I've copied from the papers. I have a different cartoon every day. For instance, when the budget was on, I had one of Winston trying to push an elephant-marked debt, and underneath it I wrote, 'Will he budge it?' See? You can have cartoons about any of the parties, but you mustn't put anything in favour of socialism, because the police won't stand it. Once I did a cartoon of a boa constrictor marked 'Capital' swallowing a rabbit marked 'Labour.' The copper came along and saw it, and he says, 'You rub that out and look sharp about it,' he says. I had to rub it out. The copper's got the right to move you on for loitering, and it's no good giving him a back answer." I asked Bozo what one could earn at screeving. He said, "This time of year when it don't rain, I take about 3 quid between Friday and Sunday. People get their wages Friday, you see. I can't work when it rains. The colours get washed off straight away. Take the year round, I make about £1 a week, because you can't do much in the winter. Boat race day and cup final day, I've took as much as £4. But you have to cut it out of them, you know. You don't take a bob if you just sit and look at them. 1/2 is the usual drop. Gift. And you don't get even that unless you give them a bit of back chat. Once they've answered you, they feel ashamed not to give you a drop. The best thing is to keep changing your picture, because when they see you drawing, they'll stop and watch you. The trouble is the beggars scatter as soon as you turn round with a hat. You really want a nobber. An assistant. At this game, you keep at work and get a crowd watching you, and a nobber comes casual-like round the back of them. They don't know he's a nobber. Then suddenly he pulls his cap off, and you've got them between 2 fires, like. You'll never get a drop off real toffs. It's shabby sort of blokes you get most off, and foreigners. I've had even sixpences off chaps and blackies and that. They're not so bloody mean as what an Englishman is. Another thing to remember is to keep your money covered up, except perhaps a penny in the hat. People won't give you anything if they see you've got a bob or two already." Bozo had the deepest contempt for the other screevers on the embankment. He called them the salmon platers. At that time, there was a screever almost every 25 yards along the embankment, 25 yards being the recognised minimum between pitches. Bozo contemptuously pointed out an old white-bearded screever 50 yards away. "You see that silly old fool? He's been doing the same picture every day for 10 years. A faithful friend, he calls it. It's of a dog pulling a child out of the water. The silly old bastard can't draw any better than a child of 10. He's learned just that one picture by rule of thumb, like you learned to put a puzzle together. There's a lot of that sort about here. They come pinching my ideas sometimes, but I don't care. The silly sods can't think of anything for themselves, so I'm always ahead of them. The whole thing with cartoons is being up to date. Once a child got its head stuck in the railings of Chelsea Bridge. Well, I heard about it, and my cartoon was on a pavement before they got the child's head out of the railings. Prompt, I am." Bozo seemed an interesting man, and I was anxious to see more of him. That evening, I went down to the embankment to meet him, as he had arranged to take Paddy and myself to a lodging house south of the river. Bozo washed his pictures off the pavement and counted his takings. It was about 16 shillings, of which he said 12 or 13 would be profit. We walked down into Lambeth. Bozo limped slowly with a queer crab-like gait, half sideways, dragging his smashed foot behind him. He carried a stick in each hand and slung his box of colours over his shoulder. As we were crossing the bridge, he stopped in one of the alcoves to rest. He fell silent for a minute or two. and then to my surprise I saw that he was looking at the stars. He touched my arm and pointed to the sky with his stick. "Say, will you look at Aldebaran? Look at the colour. Like a fucking great blood orange." From the way he spoke, he might have been an art critic in a picture gallery. I was astonished. I confess that I didn't know which Aldebaran was. Indeed, I had never even noticed that the stars were of different colours. Bozo began to give me some elementary hints on astronomy, pointing out the chief constellations. He seemed concerned at my ignorance. I said to him, surprised, "You seem to know a lot about stars." "Not a great lot. I know a bit, though. I got two letters from the Astronomer Royal thanking me for writing about meteors. Now and again I go out at night and watch for meteors. The stars are a free show. It don't cost anything to use your eyes." "What a good idea. I should never have thought of it."
"Well, you've got to take an interest in something. It don't follow that because a man's on the road he can't think of anything but tea and two slices."
"But isn't it very hard to take an interest in things? Things like stars? Living this life?"
"Screeving, you mean?" "Not necessarily. Don't need to turn you into a bloody rabbit. That is, not if you set your mind to it."
"Seems to have that effect on most people."
"Of course. Look at Paddy. A tea-swilling old moocher only fit to scrounge for fag-ends. That's the way most of them go. I despise them. But you don't need to get like that. If you've got any education, it don't matter to you if you're on the road for the rest of your life."
"Well, I've found just the contrary," I said. "It seems to me that when you take a man's money away, he's fit for nothing from that moment."
"Nah, not necessarily. If you set yourself to it, you can live the same life, rich or poor. You can still keep on with your books and your ideas. You've just got to say to yourself, 'I'm a free man in here.'" He tapped his forehead. "And you're all right."
Bozo talked further in the same strain, and I listened with attention. He seemed a very unusual screever, and he was, moreover, the first person I had heard maintain that poverty didn't matter. I saw a good deal of him during the next few days, for several times it rained and he couldn't work. He told me the history of his life, and it was a curious one. The son of a bankrupt bookseller, he had gone to work as a house painter at 18, and then served 3 years in France and India during the war. After the war, he had found a house painting job in Paris, and had stayed there several years. France suited him better than England. He despised the English. And he'd been doing well in Paris, saving money and engaged to a French girl. One day the girl was crushed to death under the wheels of an omnibus. Bozo went on the drink for a week and then returned to work, rather shaky. The same morning he fell from a stage on which he was working, 40 feet onto the pavement, and smashed his right foot to pulp. For some reason he received only £60 compensation. He returned to England, spent his money in looking for jobs, tried hawking books in Middlesex Street Market, then tried selling toys from a tray, and finally settled down as a screever. He'd lived hand to mouth ever since, half-starved throughout the winter, and often sleeping in the spike or on the embankment. When I knew him, he owned nothing but the clothes he stood up in, and his drawing materials and a few books. The clothes were the usual beggar's rags, but he wore a collar and tie, of which he was rather proud. The collar, a year or more old, was constantly going round the neck, and Bozo used to patch it with bits cut from the tail of his shirt, so that the shirt had scarcely any tail left. His damaged leg was getting worse, and would probably have to be amputated, and his knees, from kneeling on the stones, had pads of skin on them as thick as boot soles. There was clearly no future for him but beggary and a death in the workhouse. With all this, he had neither fear nor regret nor shame nor self-pity. He had faced his position and made a philosophy for himself. Being a beggar, he said, was not his fault, and he refused either to have any compunction about it or to let it trouble him. He was the enemy of society and quite ready to take to crime if he saw a good opportunity. He refused on principle to be thrifty. In the summer, he saved nothing, spending his surplus earnings on drink, as he didn't care about women. If he was penniless when winter came on, then society must look after him. He was ready to extract every penny he could from charity, provided that he was not expected to say thank you for it. He avoided religious charities, however, for he said that it stuck in his throat to sing hymns for buns. He had various other points of honour. For instance,
It was his boast that never in his life, even when starving, had he picked up a cigarette end. He considered himself in a class above the ordinary run of beggars, who, he said, were an abject lot without even the decency to be ungrateful. He spoke French passably, and had read some of Zola's novels, all Shakespeare's plays, Gulliver's Travels, and a number of essays. He could describe his adventures in words that one remembered. For instance, speaking of funerals, he said to me, "Have you ever seen a corpse burned?" "I have, in India. They put the old chap on the fire, and the next moment I almost jumped out of my skin because he'd started kicking. It was only his muscles contracting in the heat. Still, it gave me a turn. Well, he wriggled about for a bit like a kipper on hot coals, and then his belly blew up, went off with a bang you could have heard 50 yards away. It fair put me against cremation. Or again, apropos of his accident, the doctor says to me, 'You fell on one foot, my man, and bloody lucky for you you didn't fall on both feet,' he says, 'because if you'd have fallen on both feet, you'd have shut up like a bloody concertina and your thigh bones would be sticking out of your ears.'" Clearly the phrase was not the doctor's, but Bozo's own. He had a gift for phrases. He had managed to keep his brain intact and alert, and so nothing could make him succumb to poverty. He might be ragged and cold, or even starving, but so long as he could read, think, and watch for meteors, he was, as he said, free in his own mind. He was an embittered atheist, the sort of atheist who does not so much disbelieve in God as personally dislike him, and took a sort of pleasure in thinking that human affairs would never improve. Sometimes, he said, when sleeping on the embankment, it had consoled him to look up at Mars or Jupiter and think that there were probably embankment sleepers there. He had a curious theory about this. Life on Earth, he said, is harsh because the planet is poor in the necessities of existence. Mars, with its cold climate and scanty water, must be far poorer, and life correspondingly harsher. Whereas on Earth you are merely imprisoned for stealing sixpence, on Mars you are probably boiled alive. This thought cheered Bozo. I don't know why. He was a very exceptional man. Chapter 31. The charge at Bozo's lodging place was ninepence a night. It was a large, crowded place, with accommodation for 500 men, and a well-known rendezvous of tramps, beggars, and petty criminals. All races, even black and white, mixed in it on terms of equality. There were Indians there, and when I spoke to one of them in bad Urdu, he addressed me as Tum, a thing to make one shudder if it had been in India. We had got below the range of colour prejudice. One had glimpses of curious lives. Old Grandpa, a tramp of 70 who made his living, or a great part of it, by collecting cigarette ends and selling the tobacco at threepence an ounce. The doctor, he was a real doctor who had been struck off the register for some offence, and besides selling newspapers, gave medical advice at a few pence a time. A little Chittagonian Lascar, barefoot and starving, who had deserted his ship and wandered for days through London, so vague and helpless that he didn't even know the name of the city he was in. He thought it was Liverpool until I told him. A begging letter writer, a friend of Bozo's, who wrote pathetic appeals for aid to pay for his wife's funeral, and when a letter had taken effect, blew himself out with huge, solitary gorges of bread and margarine. He was a nasty, hyena-like creature. I talked to him and found that, like most swindlers, he believed a great part of his own lies. The lodging house was an Alsatia for types like these. While I was with Bozo, he taught me something about the technique of London begging. There is more about it than one might suppose. Beggars vary greatly, and there is a sharp social line between those who merely cadge and those who attempt to give some value for money. The amounts that one can earn by the different gags also vary. The stories in the Sunday papers about beggars who die with £2,000 sewn into their trousers are, of course, lies. But the better-class beggars do have runs of luck when they earn a living wage for weeks at a time. The most prosperous beggars are street acrobats and street photographers. On a good pitch, a theatre queue for instance, a street acrobat will often earn £5 a week. Street photographers can earn about the same, but they are dependent on fine weather. They have a cunning dodge to stimulate trade.
When they see a likely victim approaching, one of them runs behind the camera and pretends to take a photograph. Then, as the victim reaches them, they exclaim, "There you are, sir. Took your photo, lovely. That'll be a bob." "But I never asked you to take it," protests the victim. "What? You didn't want it took? Why, we thought you signalled with your hand. Well, there's a plate wasted. That's cost us sixpence, that has." At this, the victim usually takes pity and says he'll have the photo after all. The photographers examine the plate and say that it's spoiled and that they will take a fresh one free of charge. Of course, they haven't really taken the first photo. And so, if the victim refuses, they waste nothing. Organ grinders, like acrobats, are considered artists rather than beggars. An organ grinder named Shorty, a friend of Bozo's, told me all about his trade. He and his mate worked the coffee shops and public houses round Whitechapel and the Commercial Road. It's a mistake to think that organ grinders earn their living in the street. 9/10 of their money is taken in coffee shops and pubs. Only the cheap pubs, for they're not allowed into the good-class ones. Shorty's procedure was to stop outside a pub and play one tune, after which his mate, who had a wooden leg and could excite compassion, went in and passed round the hat. It was a point of honour with Shorty always to play another tune after receiving the drop, an encore, as it were, the idea being that he was a genuine entertainer and not merely paid to go away. He and his mate took £2 or £3 a week between them, but as they had to pay 15 shillings a week for the hire of the organ, they only averaged £1 a week each. They were on the streets from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, and later on Saturdays. Screevers can sometimes be called artists, sometimes not. Bozo introduced me to one who was a real artist. That is, he had studied art in Paris and submitted pictures to the Salon in his day. His line was copies of old masters, which he did marvellously considering that he was drawing on stone. He told me how he began as a screever. My wife and kids were starving. I was walking home late at night with a lot of drawings I'd been taking round the dealers and wondering how the devil to raise a bob or two. Then in the Strand, I saw a fellow kneeling on the pavement drawing and people giving him pennies. As I came past, he got up and went into a pub. Damn it, I thought, if he can make money at that, so can I. So on the impulse, I knelt down and began drawing with his chalks. Heaven knows how I came to do it. I must have been light-headed with hunger. The curious thing was that I'd never used pastels before. I had to learn the technique as I went along. Well, people began to stop and say that my drawing wasn't bad, and they gave me 9 pence between them. At this moment, the other fellow came out of the pub. "What in the name of Christ are you doing on my pitch?" he said. I explained that I was hungry and had to earn something. "Oh," said he, "come and have a pint with me." So I had a pint, and since that day I've been a screever. I make about £1 a week. You can't keep 6 kids on £1 a week, but luckily my wife earns a bit taking in sewing. The worst thing in this life is the cold, and the next worst is the interference you have to put up with. At first, not knowing any better, I used sometimes to copy a nude on the pavement. The first I did was outside St. Martin's in the Fields Church. A fellow in black, I suppose he was a church warden or something, came out in a tearing rage. "Do you think we can have that obscenity outside God's holy house?" he cried. So I had to wash it out. It was a copy of Botticelli's Venus. Another time I copied the same picture on the embankment. A policeman passing looked at it and then, without a word, walked onto it and rubbed it out with his great flat feet. Bozo told the same tale of police interference. At the time when I was with him, there had been a case of immoral conduct in Hyde Park, in which the police had behaved rather badly. Bozo produced a cartoon of Hyde Park, with policemen concealed in the trees and the legend, "Puzzle, find the policeman." I pointed out to him how much more telling it would be to put, "Puzzle, find the immoral conduct." But Bozo wouldn't hear of it. He said that any policeman who saw it would move him on and he would lose his pitch for good. Below screevers come the people who sing hymns, or sell matches, or bootlaces, or envelopes containing a few grains of lavender, called euphemistically perfume. All these people are frankly beggars, exploiting an appearance of misery, and none of them takes on an average more than 0.5 crown a day. The reason why they have to pretend to sell matches and so forth instead of begging outright is that this is demanded by the absurd English laws about begging. As the law now stands, If you approach a stranger and ask him for tuppence, he can call a policeman and get you 7 days for begging. But if you make the air hideous by droning, "Nearer, my God, to thee," or scrawl some chalk daubs on the pavement, or stand about with a tray of matches, in short, if you make a nuisance of yourself, you are held to be following a legitimate trade and not begging. Match-selling and street-singing are simply legalised crimes. Not profitable crimes, however. There is not a singer or match-seller in London who can be sure of £50 a year. A poor return for standing 84 hours a week on the curb with the cars grazing your backside. It's worth saying something about the social position of beggars, for when one has consorted with them and found that they are ordinary human beings, one cannot help being struck by the curious attitude that society takes towards them. People seem to feel that there is some essential difference between beggars and ordinary working men. They're a race apart, outcasts like criminals and prostitutes. Working men work. Beggars do not work. They are parasites, worthless in their very nature. It's taken for granted that a beggar does not earn his living as a bricklayer or a literary critic earns his. He is a mere social excrescence, tolerated because we live in a humane age, but essentially despicable. Yet, if one looks closely, one sees that there is no essential difference between a beggar's livelihood and that of numberless respectable people. Beggars do not work, it's said. But then what is work? A navvy works by swinging a pick. An accountant works by adding up figures. A beggar works by standing out of doors in all weathers and getting varicose veins, chronic bronchitis, etc. It is a trade like any other. Quite useless, of course, but then many reputable trades are quite useless. And as a social type, a beggar compares well with scores of others. He is honest compared with the sellers of most patent medicines, high-minded compared with a Sunday newspaper proprietor, amiable compared with a hire-purchase tout, in short, a parasite, but a fairly harmless parasite. He seldom extracts more than a bare living from the community. And what should justify him, according to our ethical ideas? He pays for it over and over in suffering. I don't think there's anything about a beggar that sets him in a different class from other people, or gives most modern men the right to despise him. Then the question arises, why are beggars despised? For they are despised universally. I believe it is for the simple reason that they fail to earn a decent living. In practice, nobody cares whether work is useful or useless, productive or parasitic. The sole thing demanded is that it should be profitable. In all the modern talk about energy, efficiency, social service and the rest of it, what meaning is there except get money, get it legally, and get a lot of it? Money has become the grand test of virtue. By this test, beggars fail, and for this they are despised. If one could earn even £10 a week at begging, it would become a respectable profession immediately. A beggar, looked at realistically, is simply a businessman getting his living, like other businessmen, in the way that comes to hand. He has not, more than most modern people, sold his honour. He has merely made the mistake of choosing a trade at which it is impossible to grow rich. Chapter 32. I want to put in some notes, as short as possible, on London slang and swearing. These, omitting the ones that everyone knows, are some of the cant words now used in London. A gagger, beggar or street performer of any kind. A moocher, one who begs outright without pretence of doing a trade. A nobbler, one who collects pennies for a beggar. A chanter, a street singer. A clodhopper, a street dancer. A mug faker, a street photographer. A glimmer, one who watches vacant motor cars. A gee, or G, it is pronounced G, the accomplice of a cheap jack, who stimulates trade by pretending to buy something. A split, a detective, a flatty, a policeman, a didikai, a gypsy, a toby, a tramp. A drop, money given to a beggar. Funkum, lavender or other perfume sold in envelopes, a boozer, a public house, a slang, a hawker's license, a kip, a place to sleep in or a night's lodging, smoke, London, a Judy, a woman, a spike, the casual ward, the lump, the casual ward, a tosheroon, a half crown, a diner, a shilling, a hog, a shilling, a sprousy, a sixpence, clods, coppers, a drum, a billy can, shackles, soup, a chat, a louse, hard up, tobacco made from cigarette ends, a stick or cane, a burglar's jemmy, a peter, a safe, a bligh, a burglar's oxyacetylene blow lamp, to bawl, to suck or swallow, to knock off, to steal, to skipper, to sleep in the open. About half of these words are in the larger dictionaries. It's interesting to guess at the derivation of some of them, though one or two, for instance, funkum and tosheroon, are beyond guessing. Dina presumably comes from denia. Glimmer, with the verb to glim, may have something to do with the old word glim meaning a light, or another old word glim meaning a glimpse. But it is an instance of the formation of new words, for in its present sense it can hardly be older than motor cars. G is a curious word. Conceivably, it has risen out of G meaning horse, in the sense of stalking horse. The derivation of screever is mysterious. It must come ultimately from scribo, but there has been no similar word in English for the past 150 years, nor can it have come directly from the French, for pavement artists are unknown in France. Judy and ball are East End words not found west of Tower Bridge. Smoke is a word used only by tramps. Kip is Danish. Till quite recently, the word doss was used in this sense, but it is now quite obsolete. London slang and dialect seem to change very rapidly. The old London accent, described by Dickens and Surtees, with V for W and W for V and so forth, has now vanished utterly. The Cockney accent, as we know it, seems to have come up in the 40s. It's first mentioned in an American book, Herman Melville's White Jacket. And Cockney is already changing. There are few people now who say fice for face, noice for nice, and so forth as consistently as they did 20 years ago. The slang changes together with the accent. 25 or 30 years ago, for instance, the rhyming slang was all the rage in London. In the rhyming slang, everything was named by something rhyming with it. A hit or miss for a kiss, plates of meat for feet, etc. It was so common that it was even reproduced in novels. Now it is almost extinct. It survives in certain abbreviations, such as use your tuppenny or use your head. Tuppenny is arrived at like this. Head, loaf of bread, tuppenny loaf, tuppenny. Perhaps all the words I've mentioned above will have vanished in another 20 years. The swear words also change, or at any rate they're subject to fashions. For example, 20 years ago the London working classes habitually used the word bloody. Now they've abandoned it utterly, though novelists still represent them as using it. No born Londoner, it is different with people of Scotch or Irish origin, now says bloody.